Okay, let's start. Sorry for this, as usual. The last topic in our course is hash functions and digital signatures. We divide this lecture in two. The first part will be about hash functions, and the second part will be about digital signatures. So the digital signatures, they use the same methods as public key crypto systems. They are based on the same difficult mathematical problems, but instead of encipherment, you digitally sign with a decipherment transformation or something very similar to the decipherment transformation. So you will see. But we start with hash functions. So, well, we are using hash functions on the daily basis, and maybe you have been interested in what is inside. So what we are going to talk about today is what is inside. Mathematically, if k and n are positive integers, then a function f with n-bit output and k-bit key is called a hash function if it has these properties. First, f is deterministic. Second, well, deterministic means the same input, the same output all the time. Now, f takes two inputs. The first input is of arbitrary length, and the second input is of length k. And f outputs a binary string of length n, which is fixed. Yeah. So if the function is with these properties, then it is called a hash function. These properties do not guarantee that this hash function is good, but this will be a hash function. Now we are going to see what does it mean to say, if we say good hash function. Yeah. Formally, it's a mapping from 0, 1 to any length, and 0, 1 to k to 0, 1 to n. Well, so you have two inputs. One is of arbitrary length, this star, and one is of length k. Now, obviously, if you fix this to any fixed value, then it is unkeyed hash function. So k is known or fixed. And if this is kept secret, then you have two inputs, really, and then the hash function is keyed. Now, why do we need keyed hash functions? For MAC, message authentication codes. So we can do message authentication code with a hash function that's called HMAC, hash function-based message authentication code, which is used for authentication of messages, as the name says. We are going to say two words about that, even though it's applied cryptography. So we are not interested in that too much in this course. We are more interested in what is inside the hash function and is it good and how it can be broken. And if key is not used, which means it is fixed or known, made known, then we can use it in digital signature schemes, which is something that we are more interested in still. It's an application, so we are not going to do that. You will hear, if you haven't heard about that, you will hear about that in some other course. Now, in order to be useful, now, what is a good hash function? So in order to be useful for cryptographic applications, any hash function must satisfy these three basic properties, and they are called levels of security. First of all, one-wayness or preimage resistance. We are going to explain each of them. Then second preimage resistance or weak collision resistance. Sometimes it's called weak collision resistance. And the strong collision resistance or just collision resistance where we assume that it is strong. We are now going to see what is what. First of all, one-wayness or preimage resistance. Well, the name says a hash function f is preimage resistance if for a random key k and an n-bit output string w, it is difficult for an attacker to find the input, to find x such that fk of x is w. So given the output of the hash function, it is difficult to find the corresponding input. K can be fixed or not, but it doesn't affect this definition. Now, this is very fluid. So what does it mean difficult? So maybe it's difficult for me, but it may not be difficult for NSA, for example. However, it's difficulty in a computational sense. So there is a lot of operations that are required to get this value X. And this number of operations is too big for any machine. If we want to do it by brute force, we can try an X. And the number of X's is actually infinite, but with some previous knowledge, if we want to cryptanalyze this, we would say, okay, we assume that the length of the message is like one page, that's 2,000 characters approximately, so we try that with the priority, but you can imagine 2,000, that's too much. No? Yeah. So this means one wayness in the computational sense. So there is no analytical way or there is no easy analytical way of getting X from W, if we know F and K. Now, second preimage distance or weak collision resistance. What does it mean? So we are looking for a second preimage. We have one, so we are given a preimage X, and we are looking for another preimage Y that gives the same value of the hash function. So that's basically what we mean by second preimage resistance, which means a hash function F is second preimage resistance if it is difficult for an attacker presented with a random key K if we use the key. So it doesn't, that doesn't matter. Doesn't affect the definition. And the random input string X to find another input string Y such that FK of X is equal to FK of Y. Now the probability of finding Y not equal to X such that these outputs are the same if X is given is 1 divided by 2 to the power of N. So you just try where N is the hash output length. So you are looking for input that will give the same output as the one that we obtain with another input X. So that's called second preimage resistance. Now, I would say a variant of this, but more complex, is, okay, we are not given any input, but we want to find two inputs that give the same output. And that's called strong collision resistance. So hash function F is collision resistant or strong collision resistant if it is difficult for an attacker to find two inputs that are not the same, such that the outputs are the same. The existence of key doesn't affect the definition, so it can be fixed. It doesn't have to be used. So that's the difference between the strong and the weak collision. Weak collision, we are given one input, and strong collision, we are not given any input, and we have to guess two inputs that give the same output. Now, the fact that we have a fixed length output and an infinite length input in theory means, since this length of the input is greater than the length of the output, then no matter what we do, the collision will exist. So that's called Dirichlet's principle or pigeonhole principle. Well, you may have met this in your bachelor studies when you studied discrete mathematics. So that's one of the basic things. If you have 19 holes and 20 pigeons, and you want to put the pigeons in the holes, then in one hole there must be two pigeons. That's the idea. So that's the collision. Yeah? So you have a fixed length output and a greater length input, no matter what it is. So there must be two inputs that will give the same output. So that's called Dirichlet's principle. So the collision always exists. Now, if you have a very short output, then you will easily find the collision. That's why we are going to explain why that. But that's why the lengths of the outputs of practical hash functions are pretty long, like 512 bits, etc., etc. So we cannot do with, they started with like 128, 160, and they turned out to be too short for today's technology to find collision by brute force. So, by the birthday paradox, after a square root of 2 to the power of n trials, which means hash value computations, we find the collision if the output length of the hash function is n. Why square root? So we are going to explain that. So, and that's the proof, you know, of this, that we need this number of trials to find collision by brute force for any hash function, good or bad. So given k randomly generated hash function, now k is not the key. So it may be misleading a bit. So k is a number here. So k randomly generated hash values. So you take a hash function and generate k values, output values of hash functions for some inputs at random, which means you get random inputs, you generate the corresponding outputs. So what's the probability that at least two of them are equal, which is a collision? So in other words, how many trials you need to find a collision? So what is this probability? Obviously, 1 minus the probability that they are all unique, so that you will not find a collision after k trials. Well, what will be the experiment? We pick one hash value at random, then the probability that the next value that we pick will be different from that value will be, obviously, now you have 1 minus the total number of possible trials, minus 1. So that's the favorite, and that's all the possible. So you have 2 to the power n minus 1 divided by 2 to the power n. So that's the probability that the next value after the first one, so the second value, will be different from that value. Now, the probability that the next randomly selected hash function will be different from the 2 previously selected ones, so we are talking about independent trials, it must be 2 to the power n minus 2 divided by 2 to the power n, etc., etc. Now we have k such, so we have tried one, we have tried the second one, etc., etc., and we have tried the kth. Okay? Now, since these are independent trials, the probability that they are all different is the product of these probabilities. And we are looking for the probability that at least 2 of them are the same, which means 1 minus this probability that they are all different. Okay? Now, what is this product? Well, it can be shown that this product is exactly this. So that's an identity that is like 200-300 years ago, it was computed that this value is exactly this. Now, if we approximate that even more, then we get an approximate formula, k squared divided by 2 times 2 to the power n. This is an important formula not only for the hash functions. If you remember, we have talked about probability of repeating the key. So if the, for example, for stream ciphers or block ciphers, so that's the same, actually. So the number of possible keys and the number of trials, which means how many, that affects the decision about how long you can keep a fixed key. So it depends on how many messages you are going to encipher. So if you encipher k messages, then the probability that after enciphering key messages where the length of the key is n, which means 2 to the power of n possible keys, that the output sequence will repeat, which means that the key will repeat, is exactly, well, approximate this, but it's almost exactly. So it's a very good approximation if n is large and k is large. So this is all only about this computation. That's why I have provided this computation. It's not important only for the hash functions. So to prove, to show how many trials you need to find a collision. It's also important to know how many messages you can encipher with a fixed length key, in order for the keys not to be repeated or to repeat with very small probability. Now, if you say that the probability that you need is 1/2, and after 1/2, it's more than 1/2, which means that it will be closer to 1, which means that the hash function in this case will be broken, is then From this formula, you easily get that it is 2 to the power of n divided by 2. So it's square root of 2 to the power of n. So you don't have to try 2 to the power of n. It will be enough to try square root of 2 to the power of n. Now, if n is large, this square root will not help you much, but still it's much smaller than 2 to the power of n. Then, this is if the function is collision-resistant, which means any function. Now, the bad functions, you will find the collisions before this. So with the smaller number of trials, that's the problem with bagged hash functions. Now, typical values for n are 160, 256, 512, etc., etc., and it's getting greater and greater, and it is not a problem today because the technology has advanced and we have very fast hardware. For example, if n is 160, like the hash functions whose length was this 160, it was like 20, 30 years ago, so they have been used, like RIPEMD and the others, you will see. So for p equal to 1/2 this probability of collision, we have to try 1.42 times 10 to the power 24, which is actually doable. That's why they increased the length. So as we said, this computation holds for a collision-resistant hash function. So that collision-resistant is the one for which we have to find, to try all these before we find the collision. But the bad hash functions, this k is smaller than that. So if we can find a collision with a smaller number of trials, then the hash function is bad. So it's broken, it's not collision resistant. Now, why are we talking so much about collision resistance and not too much with the other two properties? First of all, the collision resistance implies the second preimage, which means if a hash function is collision resistant, then it is second preimage resistant. So it's guaranteed. However, we have a problem with second preimage and one-wayness. So these do not follow from each other. Still, a hash function, it can be built. So if you really want to build a bad hash function, you can do that. So a hash function that would be preimage resistant, but not second preimage resistant. But that would be quite artificial, and why should we do that? We need good hash functions, not the bad ones. Sometimes, actually, we do need bad hash functions, but not in cryptography. So sometimes if we use them for search, then we would like similar objects to have similar values of the hash function. But these hash functions are special. So these are not cryptographic hash functions. So we have seen that in practice, collision resistance is the strongest security requirement, and it is the most difficult to satisfy and the easiest to break. So usually, if the collision resistance property is broken, then the hash function is considered broken. And because of that, the goal of most attacks on hash functions is actually to break the collision resistance, which means to find the collision without trying all these square roots of 2 to the power of n independent values of hash function. There are other important properties of hash functions which have some meaning for cryptography. For example, the avalanche property, which means changing a single bit of the input causes change of approximately 1/2 bits of the output. That's called the avalanche property. Of course, this is the most important property of all, because this is why we need hash functions. So we would like to ensure the integrity of data, which means take the hash function of the piece of data, and then if the data is changed, then it will be noticed. So it will be noticed even if we change just a single bit. That's why we need cryptographic hash functions mostly. And then local one-wayness, this is more about security. So no input bits can be reliably guessed based on the hash function's local output, which means you take not only not 512 bits of output, you take two. So if you can relate these two with some bits of the input, then you have broken the hash function. So you break one wayness. Now, if the function fails to satisfy these properties, it's called certificational weakness. That means the hash function is useless. In the first case, you cannot use it in cryptography because we need it for ensuring integrity of data. In the second case, it's not secure. So one wayness is broken. Now, in addition to all this, a hash function must be feasible to compute given X and eventually K if we need the key. And this is the reason why some theoretically strong designs that would be collision resistant and first preimage resistant, because second preimage it follows from the collision resistant, they are not used in practice. They are just too slow. And they are too slow usually because they are based on difficult mathematical problems, and when we deal with these difficult mathematical problems, you have already noticed we need a lot of operations, like with RSA, with El Gamal, etc. So we have seen that to encipher and decipher, you need a lot of complicated operations. So-called algebraic hash functions are based on the same difficult mathematical problems that are used in public key cryptography, like factoring. So that's Shamir's hash function, based on factoring. So it exists. And then like this one, based on discrete log, Shaum, Van Heist, Fitzmann's function. So these three authors, they proposed this hash function whose good properties are based on impossibility of, well, in practice, of course, solving the discrete logarithm problem. So what is used in RSA is factoring. What is used in NGAMAL is discrete log. So these two problems, we have seen that we have problems with these problems because they are probably not NP complete. But anyway, they are used a lot in practice. And there are some newer designs like VSH, very strong hash. It's based on factoring or based on lattice. This is post-quantum, so this might be interesting. So this LASH. So we are not considering the lattice problem in this course, but that's a promising solution for post-quantum cryptography. And some special designs like those based on modular arithmetic and symmetric ciphers like this Dakota. So in Denmark, they are very, very engaged on these problems. Professor Lars Knudsen, maybe you have heard of him. So he is one of the authors of some of these designs. So Nordic countries. Now, how can we construct hash functions? So we need a function that gives fixed length output based on infinite length input, and maybe we need a key. So we can, in one case, like this Davis-Meyer construction, which is old and not very much used today, but they try to iterate a block cipher. So you take TES, for example, and you iterate it in the form in which it is. So the input block is X and the key is K. So that's the block cipher. So it has X as input block and K is the key. Now the block length is N and the key length is M. And it is not required that M is greater than N, which may be appealing actually, because you can take off the shelf block cipher and just iterate it and get a hash function. And that's why they actually use that. So each m-bit substring of the string to be hashed is fed into the block cipher as a key input. That's typical. So unlike block ciphers, when we use them as block ciphers, actually the input to the hash function is fed on the key side, not on the block side. So you will see that also in some other constructions. So what we do is partition the input string into substrings of length M, which is the length of the key. Remember that. If the length of the input string is not a multiple of M, we have to pad it. So the length must be a multiple of M. So the padding string can be, well, that's a separate science. So suppose we pad with three zeros, so we are not considering that why this or that padding string is good or bad. So just theoretically, we need padding because you have to iterate a block function some number of times, depending on the length of the input, and the last block cipher that you add must have this input from the key side also of length m. If it is shorter, then we have to add some bits. So that's called padding. We have seen that with block ciphers when we use them as block ciphers, not as stream ciphers. The padding algorithm depends on the concrete hash function. So when you actually read the descriptions of the hash function, then it is always given how we pad. So the procedure would be like this in this Davis-Meyer construction. So remember, you iterate an off-the-shelf block function. So you don't change anything on that. Input is the bit string Y. We partition this string Y into m-bit blocks, where m is the block cipher's key size. So we have said that several times so far. Then if padding is needed, do the padding to complete the last block. And then a constant n-bit value of the initialization vector must be specified. So it depends on whether we need the key or not. So if we need the key, then it will be used on this IV side. If we not, we just fix that. The block size of the iterated cipher is n, so IV is the first input to the block cipher. It plays the role if we use it as MAC, because then it's the key. So mathematically, Y prime would be the padded string, input string. So Y prime, Y1 prime, concatenated with Y2 prime, etc., etc., YR prime. And these are of length M, these YIs prime. And the last one is padded. So if Y is the input, then Y prime is the padded input. We divide it in two chunks of length M. And then we iterate the hash function. F0 is IV, and then Fi is G of Fi minus 1, Y prime, Yi prime, plus this F of I minus 1. So this is not just iteration, you need this sum. And of course, the hash value is the last output, so it's the length N. Which is like this. So this is our block cipher, this G. It has the input from the block side. In the first one, it will be this IV, so it may be the key. If not, then you fix it. Y1 prime is the first chunk of m bits of the padded input. Then the output of the block cipher is summed with this input of the block cipher. And then it is iterated as many times as needed. This R is actually how many chunks of length M we have in the padded input. And the output is the last output, of course, summed with the last input. So that's the Davis-Meyer construction. It has been used for some old hash functions. Now, a variant of this is the Merkle-Damgård construction, variant in the sense that we also have iterated block cipher. However, first, we don't have this sum. The second, the block length input is greater than the output. So the input length is greater than the output length of this iterated function. So it cannot be an off-the-shelf block cipher. It must be what is called a compression function, which takes a fixed length input and it outputs a fixed length output which is shorter than that. That's why it is called compression function. So that's Merkle-Damgård construction. So in practice, you can use symmetric ciphers, but special ones. So special block ciphers. So what you do will be more or less the same as with Davis-Meyer, but it is now required that the length of the key is greater than the length of the output of the block cipher. So the length of the block X is n bit, and the length of the key is m bit. The hash function has, as the Davis-Mayer or all the others, theoretically unlimited length of the input string. You just repeat this compression function as many times as needed, and this is determined by the length of this input string. And the output bit length will be n, the length of the block. So you can imagine, you could actually, for example, you can imagine Kasumi. If you remember, we had a cipher with 64-bit block and 128 bits of key. So this could be used as a compression function because m, the length of the key, is greater than n, the length of the block. So this is required for the Merkle-Damgård construction. So it works the same way as Davis-Mayer, but we don't have this sum of the output with the input. So we pad first into chunks of length m. So the padded input is some integer times the constant m. And then f0 will be a fixed initialization vector of length n. Well, it's IV, the same as IV in the Davis-Mayer construction. Then we just do this. Fi is g of fi minus 1 wire path. So there is no plus the input as with the Davis-Mayer construction. Finally, f is equal to fr, and the padding algorithm and f0 depend on the concrete hash function. F0, of course, if you need the key, then there is no algorithm. But if you don't need the key, what will be the value of this fixed key depends on the design. Well, the scheme is the same, almost the same. So what is missing here is this plus. So you would have a plus with Davis-Mayer of input and the output of the block cipher. So you don't have this in the Merkle-Damgård construction, but it is required that this length here, the length of the key, is greater than the length of the block, which means if m is greater than n, this g is a compression function. So it compresses from m to n each time. So the length will be n of the output. What is the advantage here? It is efficient, which means fast if we use a special compression function, not off-the-shelf block cipher. It's usually the case. And these are usually already implemented. So they have... why are they fast? They usually have a small number of rounds, unlike off-the-shelf block ciphers. The disadvantage is, well, we can employ a strong block cipher here, like Kasumi. We could do that, but it doesn't guarantee that the function, the hash function, will be good, so that the collision resistance will be guaranteed. Examples of Merkle-Damgård designs, we meet them very often, actually, in practice, especially this MD5, even though it's broken. So everybody knows that the collision has been found with smaller than square root of 2 to the power 128 trials. So n is 128, and we have MD4, it was broken immediately, and MD5, it has been broken like 15 years ago, maybe 20, but still, when you download software, very often on the internet, you have MD5 hash value. Why? We don't know. It's not secure. And then we have the NIST SHA secure hash algorithm family of hash functions, SHA-1 with 160 bits of output, considered broken today, SHA-2 with 256 and 512-bit output. So if you use SHA-2, it's pretty safe. And all these designs, they use these custom block cipher rounds. The speed depends on the number of rounds in these custom block ciphers. For example, MD4, just 3 rounds, ultra fast but insecure. So collision has been found immediately. MD5, it has 4 rounds, it's more secure, but it's 30% slower than MD4. However, with today's hardware and software, it should not be a problem. The greater problem is that it's actually broken. So MD5 collisions have been found. So we have so far seen two possible constructions. Now, the most recent one is the sponge construction. It's like 10 years old. So we have a fixed length permutation of 2 to the power of n elements, which is actually, how did we call that when we talked about block cipher? Vectorial Boolean function. Okay? Nonlinear. And we have a padding rule. So if the input's length is not the multiple of the block length, well, key length, actually, then we have to pad. This results in what we call a sponge function, which has variable length input, which means arbitrary length, actually, and fixed length output, but you can choose the length of the output, unlike some other constructions. And we are going to see how. This function operates on a finite structure that is called state. And this state is very, this idea is very similar to what we have in AES. So we have some state on which we iterate some operations. So, and actually the authors are the same. So it operates on a finite state by iteratively applying the permutation to it, and we mix that with interleave that with entry of input or retrieval of output if we are in, you will see it has two phases. So, and we are going to see why it is called sponge construction. Okay, so we have a fixed length permutation that operates on the fixed number of bits. It is called the width. So the width is divided in two parts. The first one is called the bit rate, R, and the second one is called capacity, C. But in total, the length is B. So this B means that we have this function, which is a permutation of the set of 2 to the power of B elements. We have seen that, for example, when we talked about block cipher. So a block cipher is a permutation of 2 to the power of N elements for a fixed key. So how does the sponge construction works? So you have this special permutation, F, and in the beginning, the input is zero to that. So input means the address. So this is a function in memory. It's a table, fixed table in memory. Okay? Of course, it can be realized as a fixed table in memory in theory, but in practice, if you read the description of some hash functions based on this sponge construction, you will see that it is not done this way because it's impossible. That table would be too big. But it is produced in a different way. We have seen that when we talked about block ciphers. There we have rounds. Here we don't have rounds, we have some layers. But anyway, the idea is that instead of a fixed table in memory, we use some complicated construction, but which does not consume so much memory. Okay, so the input with the initial address is zero. Now what we do is use the padded input, and the first R bits. R is the bit rate, you see. So bit rate means how many bits at a time of the input you process. So sum the input R bits with this address, which is all zeros, so this will be the same value on output. So you have the first R bits of the input here. Now, the second part of the address will be zero bits in the beginning. So this forms the address, concatenation of these two. Now you address the function F, you get some output. Okay? Now this output is divided into two parts. The output will be also of length B. So B address, B output. So each cell in this table is of length B. So B is R plus C. So you take R bits and sum them with the next R bits of the padded input. And it would serve as the first part, the bit rate part of the address of the next repetition of F. And C bits, you see, the output part. C bits you need for making the address of the second application of F, etc., etc. So you do that as many times as needed, depending on the length of the padded input. Once you have consumed the input, it's called absorbing phase. So suppose you have a sponge, put it in water. Okay. So when you take out the sponge from water, you have absorbed this water, this quantity of water. So that's this quantity of input. Now you want some output. Squeeze. So that's the squeezing phase. So if I want the output length of, say, 2R bits, then I use one repetition of F on the output. You see? If I want 3R bits, I use another one, etc., etc. So I can make N variable, the length of the outputs. That's called the squeezing phase. Here we do not consume input, we actually generate the output. So each time we apply a function F, we get R additional bits of output. Concatenation gives N bits of output. So that's called the sponge construction. We have absorbing phase where we absorb the input. Okay? Once we do that, then we can generate output by this, by means of this squeezing phase, which is more or less the same function repeated, but without this sum with input, because there is no more input. So this is how this works in theory. Now, how do we realize F? I have said that you cannot, in general, if the function has to be any good, you cannot just make a table in memory. That would be too much memory. Because of that, there are special ways depend on the design. How do we get this permutation? Now, the next couple of slides is just a repetition of what I have said. So, how does it work? The input binary string is padded to a string whose length is a multiple of R. Then the padded string is partitioned into blocks of length R each. And we have two phases of operation, the absorption and the squeezing phase. In the absorption phase, you see, we consume, etc., etc. In the squeezing phase, we generate R bits at a time when we apply a function F. The bit rate R determines efficiency. If we have a small bit rate, then we have a lot of applications of F. That will be slow. So we would like to consume as many bits at a time as possible, but the capacity C determines the level of security against an attack whose goal is to find the collision. That's why we cannot consume B bits at a time. That would actually make the attack easier. So approximately 2 to the power of C divided by 2 attempts are necessary to find the collision in a brute force attack. Square root of 2 to the power of C. So we have seen that. Now, concrete designs are SHA-3. The winner of the SHA-3 contest 2012, so already 11 years ago, it's called Ketchak. Now, how do we realize function F there? It's a complex three-dimensional state structure with is up to 1600 bits there. So this is B. So if you want this directly in memory, that's impossible. So you will have 2 to the power of 1600 cells, each of them with 1600 bits. So that's not possible to do. Because of that, we generate this permutation as a complex structure that contains rounds. So more or less what we do with block ciphers. So the number of rounds depends on the width. The maximum width is 1600. It can be smaller. This function. Kiachak is probably secure against known attacks to find the collision. Now, there are known attacks. Maybe some unknown attack can be applied. So, currently, it's gaining popularity, not only because of useful property of possibility to choose the output length, but for security as well, because of these guaranteed or probably secure against known attacks. Okay, let's have a break.
Mange er det som pleier å være her?
Fem-seks stykker.
Det er bra. Jeg har lam der inne, og Vi har flere studenter enn vi har pulter, så vi kunne låne noen pulter herfra.
Vær så god.
Så da har vi hentet noen pulter og sett inn igjen etterpå.
Ja, ja.
De kan være dyrt i kobber.
Ja, men ikke den, men jeg tar de to der som denne. Thank you.
Regarding the practical solutions, these have been broken so far, ND5 and SHA-1. Collisions were found even for texts that are understandable. So two documents, and you find that in this paper by Stevens from 2017. So a concrete collision in SHA-1, two inputs with the same output. So SHA-1 is 160 bits of output. So two different PDF files, they have meaningful text, so it's not just garbage, that produce the same SHA-1 output. Now, to find these, how much effort is needed? Well, 6,500 CPU years and 100 GPU years for this attack, only on SHA-1 with 160 bits. So they ran in parallel, of course, many, many machines. And they managed. They actually produced two inputs with the same SHA-1 output, which means SHA-1 is considered broken. Of course, if you want to use these functions, you take some risk. But in practice, it's very difficult to find the collision even with these functions. Well, anyway, if you want to be secure, you use other functions like SHA-2. So the longer the output, the smaller is the probability of finding a collision with an attack that would not include the brute force, which means square root of 2 to the power of n trials. That's why they go for greater length attacks. And that's why Ketchak is actually good, because if you are not satisfied with R bits of output, then you take 2R or 3R. So you can have variable security with this. So there was a contest very similar to what they did in the year 2000 for AES. So the candidates, etc., etc., and these guys, they actually won with Ketchak. It is now SHA-3. Very short about applications. We are going to mention MUC, and we are going to mention digital signature schemes. And in the end of this lecture, after we talk about digital signatures, we are getting back to that. And we are going to mention blockchains, because blockchains is now a hot topic, but you will see that it's nothing special. Okay, so for data integrity protection, as we said, unkeyed hash functions are used, and that's the most important application of hash functions. That's for ensuring integrity of data. And for this, this avalanche property, as we have said, is very important. So changing a bit of input will approximately half of the bits will be changed. Then authentication, then we need the keyed hash functions. So that's message authentication code, and we have a standard. It's called RFC 2104. It's not standard, of course. It's not ISO, but RFC, you know, request for comments. You know? So a proposal that everybody uses, more or less. So these three authors, they actually published that in 1996. And this is actually used in practice extensively for message authentication codes. So this is used to prove that both sides have a key. And of course, application involving blockchains like smart contracts, digital money, etc., etc. We are not going to details of application, but we are going to explain the essential blockchain. Okay, start with the MAC. So integrity we discuss in the end of the lecture after we discuss digital signatures. We start with HMAC, RFC 2104. We need a key, that's K. M is a message, and H is a hash function. Well, we suppose that it is good. Then, how do we get this HMAC? with the key and the message as input. You see, we apply the hash function twice. So first time, we concatenate K1 and M. Mem is a message. K1 is a constant. K plus, well, the constant 36 in hexadecimal. Now it's 0011 0110. Repeated. That's called inner padding. So we sum this bit by bit, modulo 2, with the key. So this will serve as the input to the first application of the hash function. Then we take the output of the hash function, and then we do this, outer padding. So we get this value K2. K2 will be 5C repeated, plus modulo 2 bit by bit, the key. And we get this K2. We concatenate K2 with the output of the hash function and use that as the input to the second application of the hash function. So that's how we get this HMAC. Now the question is, why this? Well, read the paper. So guarantees the security, etc. So how do we use MAC in general? So instead of this HMAC, it can be MAC function, some other function. But usually this. So we have a message and the key. We use HMAC algorithm. We produce HMAC 1 by using this. So HMAC algorithm is our RFC 2104. So we produce this value. We send that together with the message. Message in open, because we are only here. We want to check the integrity of data. To check that both parties have the same key. Now, of course, you can encrypt the message, but it's independent of this procedure. Okay, so you send HMAC 1. So what does the receiving party do? They have the same algorithm. They should have the same key, otherwise it will not work. This is why we are using MAC. So they take the message received, use this and the key as input to HMAC algorithm. If you have the same input, since remember hash function is a deterministic function, you must get the same output. And that's HMAC 2. It should be the same as HMAC 1. If yes, then the receiving party knows that the sending party has the same key. Okay? Now, if you want this party to check that, then the other way around. So this is extremely very much used in practice, so in mobile telephony, any communication. Now blockchains, so they are used to securely store all the transactions, if we are talking about digital money and the non-centralized system, which means everybody can check all the transactions anytime. That's the idea. And you cannot change anything. Once done, cannot be changed. And in other applications, not money, it can be a contract. So once signed, cannot be changed. So how do we guarantee that? We need some cryptographic components, hash functions, and digital signatures. And we need some other technical components that are not cryptographic, like pointers. You have been programming, so you know what pointers are. Hash pointers, something that we are going to explain today, and directed acyclic graphs in some applications. So what we need for blockchain is a hash pointer. That's the basic component of a blockchain. So we start with the ordinary pointer. It's an address of a data unit. And it is used to make chains of data units, linked lists. You have been working with that. So that's dynamic memory allocation. Instead of statically assigning a lot of memory to some variable, to some array, then you say this is a pointer to that array, and then as the data arrive, you put them into this linked list. So instead of reserving a large amount of memory in advance, this is called static allocation, and this is done on stack, if you remember. You do this, which is done on heap, and you have a lot of memory for that. So we use only a pointer to the last data unit. So it will be a pointer to the array. So that's the only thing that we need at this moment. And then the last data unit contains a pointer to the next data unit, etc., until the first data unit. And sometimes it's done in a circle, so the last points to the first. It's not compulsory, but it's very often done. So, if we do not know the size of the data block in advance, this is useful, because we save memory. And that's why they have been actually introduced. And to retrieve or read certain data unit, and this is bad actually, we have to browse through the whole chain until we get to that particular data unit. This is time consuming, obviously. So it's easier to address a fixed amount of data, but we cannot do it because we don't have enough memory for that. Then we have this stack overflow. So this takes time, this addressing, but usually it's not a problem, or we have to live with this because we don't have other solutions regarding the amount of memory that we need. So a linked list will be something like that. The top pointer, that's what the program sees in the beginning. Now, if you say, give me the array of 5, which is here, that means, okay, the first pointer will point to the first piece of data, but that first piece of data will point to the second piece of data, etc., until the fifth piece of data. So, which means I have to follow these pointers until this piece of data that I need. So this takes time, but I get my data. So that's a linked list. So the end may point to the beginning sometimes. Doesn't matter for this purpose. Now, what is a hash pointer? Very similar. It's a data structure that points to the next data unit, but also contains the hash value of this data unit, by which we can check the integrity of this data unit, whether it has been changed. Okay? So this is the basic structure of a blockchain. So what is a blockchain? It's a linked list that uses hash pointers instead of usual pointers. That's it. So that's a lot of hype, etc., but it's just that. It is also used to make chains of data blocks. This guarantees the data integrity because of the avalanche property of the hash function. So one bit of input changed, half of the bits of the output will be changed. Well, that's what makes these hash functions useful in cryptography. And this also guarantees sequence, timestamps, etc., of data. We can put them there in these data units, whatever we want. And the sequence is guaranteed because it's a linked list. You cannot get to this part without browsing through all of those. Now, this blockchain requires that the top hash pointer, this one, pointer to the whole chain, cannot be changed by anybody, which means you can put it as public. So to check the integrity of a data unit, we have to compute the hash values of all data units from the top to this piece of data in question. And all hash values obtained in this process must be equal to the hash values contained in the hash pointer. Well, that's very easy principle. So I have a hash pointer in which I have a hash of the data to which the pointer points. Okay? I take this piece of data, compute the hash, and compare it with this hash in the hash pointer. They must be the same. If not, then some data units between the top and this unit have been changed. So, alarm sounds. Everybody can check integrity of the data units because this is public. So, the hash pointer is public. So, that's decentralization. That's required for digital money. If we don't want a central bank to control it. And that was the initial idea. The first block in the blockchain is called the Genesis block. Doesn't matter too much, but it's just terminology. So this is a blockchain. So we have initial hash pointer points to the first piece of data. You can check the integrity of that piece of data anytime by computing the hash function of this and comparing with this hash, etc., etc. Okay, I'm an attacker. I want to attack this. So what do? I change this piece of data. Okay? Then, when you check, you start with this and say, I want this piece of data. So I do this. This is good. So this hash is the same as this hash. But this is not good because it was changed. And that's why we say, this is integrity of this piece of data has been violated. So that's how it is detected. But obviously, this requires collision resistance, because otherwise it's actually weak collision. So we know one input, and we would like to find another input that gives the same output, you see. So that's actually, but as we said, weak collision resistance is a consequence of strong collision resistance. Because of that, if the hash function is strong collision resistant, it is also weak collision resistant. Now, these two properties are related. That's why the requirement for the hash function is strong collision resistance. Now, what if I say, okay, I change this piece of data, then I change this piece of data and go to the top, like this. Then we detect the change here, because this is known by everybody. Once we compute a wrong hash value, it will be detected here. So to succeed with the attack, the hash value of the changed data unit must be equal to the hash value of the original data unit. So you can cheat if you find that the hash function is not good enough, that it is not collision resistant. In this case, actually weak collision or second preimage resistant. Like this. So if you have a bad hash function, that gives H prime of a changed piece of data equal to the hash value of the original piece of data. So that's collision here, the weak collision. So the old one was known, and the new one is found. And the change will not be detected. So the hash function is bad. And because of that, we have weak collision. So this is the original blockchain. Now, we can make it run faster if we put the data into a tree, and that tree is called the Merkle tree, and this is how it is actually done in practice. So what is Merkle tree? It's a binary tree built with hash pointers. Data units are leaves of this tree, which means group the data units in pairs. They are called leaves. For each pair, make a special structure that contains not one hash pointer, two pointers, one for each data unit in the pair. And then group these structures, these two hash pointers, in pairs, etc., etc., up to the root of the tree. The top hash pointer points to the whole Merkle tree. So it's a simple concept, but you see, you have the data just on the leaves. And then you have hashes of hashes. So we have hash of this one, hash of that one. So we make this structure. This is two hash pointers. Here the same, two hash pointers. But then the next level, I compute the hash value of the structure, not of the data. I get two more hash pointers, etc., etc., until the end. It depends on how many of these we have. Logarithm for the base 2 of the number of these leaves will be the number of levels. So you know that. So it's the binary tree. There is a unique path from the root to every data unit, obviously, if I go here. So only one way to get here. This enables a simple check if data unit was changed. If it was changed, its hash value will not be equal to the hash value stored in the hash pointer. So if it is changed, this will be different. Then this will be wrong. This will be wrong, so you detect the change. If the attacker continues to change the hash values up to the top, the same as before, it will be detected here. Now, in this structure, we can simply prove membership. So, is the piece of data member of the blockchain or member of this Merkle tree? We provide the data unit and all the hash value up to the root. So all these will be computed. We ignore the rest of the Merkle tree. We forget about that. And we check that easily because the hash value on the top will be what we need. Why do we like Merkle tree? Because it's faster to operate with it. It's more effective than the same procedure in a usual blockchain. In the usual blockchain, you have to go through the whole chain to the piece of data. Here you go through the hash values, and that's and the number of levels is logarithm for the base 2 of the number of leaves. The hash value is usually short. That's another reason why this is faster. So if you have a big piece of data to compute the hash value, it will take some time because you have to repeat. You see the Merkle-Damgård construction. This iterated function has to be repeated many times. Now, you do that once. And then the next time, the piece of the data on the next level, it will be short. It will be just a hash function. A very small, relatively small number of bits. So the rest of the computation up to the root will be much faster. So that would be a simple proof of membership. So you check the hash values on the path. You can also sort Merkle tree, some lexicographic, for example, lexicographic order, usually. So that's one of the possible ordering functions. There may be others, but this is usual. So then we can prove non-membership in a simple way. You provide the path from the member immediately preceding the data unit and immediately following the data unit. In between, there must not be anything. No? So if they are neighbors, then the data unit that you are trying to insert into the blockchain, it will not be accepted. Because you have proved that these two are neighbors. So in between, there must not be anything. That's an interesting application of a blockchain. Now, how secure are blockchains? Practical security, we are talking about practical security. Theoretically, of course, it's not secure. Because the concepts such as pre-image resistance or collision resistance are just theoretical. There are no such functions in theory. Now, they are just practically secure. We only assume that the hash function that is used in such a system has these properties. And if not, if the collision is found, everything fails. So you can have two pieces of data with the same hash, then the change will not be noticed, even though the hash pointer to the whole structure is public. The hash functions used in practice have all these properties, but statistically speaking, this means it is possible to find a collision occasionally for some hash functions without trying all the possible inputs. The fact that it is not possible to find a collision using a method different to a brute force doesn't mean that a simple way doesn't exist. Somebody in the future can find it. And that's why we are talking about practical security. If we find the collision without brute force, then we consider the system broken, even though, well, it's small probability, even though it is considered broken. So that was about hash functions and the applications, except the application for integrity of data, even though with the blockchain we have seen that the avalanche property is used for that. Its integrity check. Now, Something about digital signatures. You will see that the algorithms or mathematical problems on which digital signature is based, they are familiar. So we have used them for encipherment, so for encryption. Now we use them in the RSA case, the same algorithm for digital signature, and in the Elgamal case, a bit different, but based on the same problem. So what is a digital signature? It's a number or a set of numbers that depend on some secret known only to the signer and on the content of the signed message. So we have the content and some secret that only the signer knows, and based on that we produce a number or some set of numbers, like in Elgamal case. You will see that we have two numbers. And there should not be a way of forging, which means if we don't know this secret and the content, then we cannot repeat this procedure of generating the signature. That's, well, the concept is the same as paper signature. So you should be able to sign the same way as the signer does. But in the case of paper, you don't have to know any secret. The secret is how he or she signs. So it's more or less physical activity, not a number that you have to know to forge. But here you have to know a secret number or some other structure that is secret. Now, it's not only that. This signature has to be verifiable. In the case of somebody repudiating a signature, which means I have signed, but I have said that I say that I have not signed. Okay? So, for example, I signed some contract for a loan, and later I see another bank that can give me a better condition for this loan, and then I say to the first bank, I didn't sign this. So that's called repudiation. Okay? Or usually a fraudulent claimant, which means somebody signs it and pretending to be me. Where do we apply that? In authentication procedures, in data integrity protection and non-repudiation, and in certification of public keys in large networks. So we have probably already used this. So how can we do digital signature? We need some basic elements. First of all, messages. The set of messages that can be signed. Call it M. Then we have a set of signatures, some binary strings of fixed lines, so some numbers. We call this set S. And the transform. So signing transform for Alice, who signs, so we call it SA. What is that? It's a mapping from the set of messages to the set of signatures. Nobody knows this SA except Alice. And it is used to create signatures from messages. Okay? Now, everybody can verify. So verification transform is known by everybody. So the signing transform is secret, but the verification transform is public. So it's a mapping from message and the signature to true or false. True if the signature is authentic, false if not. So as we said, everybody knows the verification transform, and we use this to verify signatures created by Alice. Now, of course, to be practical, such a system must be such that this SA and VA should be feasible to compute in some reasonable time. And it should not be computationally feasible to forge a digital signature on a message. So, given X, only Alice should be able to compute the signature Y, such that VA of XY is true. VA is the verification transform. So how does Alice sign? She takes the message X that she wants to sign, uses the algorithm SA to compute the signature over the message X. Then she publishes or sends to some recipient the message to Bob, the message X, together with the signature. Y is SA of X. But only she knows SA. How does Bob verify? He receives, Bob receives X and Y. X is the message and Y is the signature. And then VA, the verification algorithm, everybody knows, including Bob, so he uses VA of X, Y. And if the output of VA is true, then he knows that Alice's signature is authentic. It can be shown that asymmetric ciphers can be used for digital signature purposes, public key ciphers, because you need the public verification algorithm. So that's difficult to do with symmetric ciphers. And to prevent forgery, it should be infeasible for an attacker to retrieve the secret information used for signing. So this SA is difficult to break. So go the other way around. Well, this is in theory. In practice, how do we realize that? Well, we can do it with RSA, for example. So Alice signs by deciphering transformation. So she knows the secret part of the key. So each user only has this D for him or herself. Nobody else knows that. And we can use that, because of that, we can use that to sign. So instead of X to E modulo N, we use X to D modulo N. But the transform is the same. That's why RSA is so popular. Because you can realize the encryption and the digital signature with the same algorithm. And you can do that because Alice is the only one that knows DA. Bob verifies by powering as well. He uses the public key, so EA, modulo NA. So that's actually, if everything is okay, then C must be equal to X. Because we have seen that if you repeat the transform two times, then you get the original message. So that was the requirement that is actually needed for digital signature. So that was RSA definition of public key, if you remember our first lecture on public key. Now, Eve is the attacker, and she wants to sign her own message, X prime, which is not equal to X, with Alice's signature. So she wants to forge Alice's signature. Of course, she does not know DA. She only knows EA and NA. Okay? So how can she do that? She cannot do it. Because if she uses a forged message, then this will not be equal. So it will not be equal to X. Okay? So this C. So C will be not equal to X prime. Now, that's one possibility. Another possibility is to use another signature, Y prime, such that X prime is Y prime to EA modulo NA. So finding this Y prime is a difficult problem because of the factoring problem. And she can also do this. She can choose Y prime first and then generate the message. So she can do this, take Y prime, any, raise to EA, everybody knows EA, that's public key, modulo NA, the second part of the public key, so you get some X prime, and this will be verified. However, what is the probability that this X prime is meaningful? It's very small. So I take any string, raised to the power EA, modulo NA, I get some X prime. But this X prime can be just garbage, and that's in 99.99% of the cases. So even though this will be verified by Bob, it will not help Eve to do anything useful with this. Now, of course, there is another attack on this. But that's the attack against RSA. Take NA and find the factors. So if you can do that, then you get DA. And that's another story. So if I know P and Q, then I compute phi of n. And because of that, I find dA by using the extended Euclidean algorithm. That's very easy. And then I break the whole system. But as we said, it's difficult because factoring is difficult, finding P and Q. So what about L-gamal? L-gamal cannot be directly used for digital signature, but with some tricks it can be used. So Alice wants to sign a message with the L-gamal scheme. She chooses a large prime P and the generator G modulo P, and she picks a secret number A and computes B is G to A modulo P. That's the same as she did with L-gamal encryption. Okay, so that's all known. So her public key is PGB, as usual. Now, how can she sign? The message is M, and then Alice selects a secret random number K with these properties, and she computes two values, R and S. So R is G to K modulo P, and S is K to the power of minus 1, which means inverse of K modulo P minus 1, actually, times M minus AR. So that makes S dependent on M on the message. The signed message is the triple M, R, and S. Okay, how do we verify? Bob gets Alice's public key, PGB, and computes two values also. So V1 is B to R, R to S. R and S he has received from Alice. So he computes this modulo P. And then V2, G to M, the message, modulo P. These two numbers have to be the same to verify. The same modulo P. Well, the proof. The proof, M, R, and S assume it is a valid signature. So what happens then? S, by definition of S, here is this. Inverse of K times M minus I R. Modulo P minus 1. Okay? So we transform that a bit. So this is K to the power of minus 1. That means that we can write SK. So multiply by K. So SK will be then, this is 1 then, M minus IR modulo P minus 1. Or if we put M on the left side and everything else on the right side, we get M is SK plus AR modulo P minus 1. Now, V2 is G to M. Okay? And M is this. So G to SK plus AR. Now, this is modulo P minus 1 on exponent, but it can be shown, well, some mathematics, that this congruence in exponent, modulo P minus 1, yields the overall congruence modulo P, which is nice. That's what we need. Then we can write this as G to A to R times G to K to S. And G to A to R, G to A is B. Where is this? G to A is B. And G to K is R. G to K is R. She computes this. And this B is G to A, as we said. So this is something that we did before signing. So that's the part of the public key. So this is B, and we have B to R, and this is R, we have R to S. And B to R times R to S, that's actually V1. So the trick here, the only trick here, the rest is easy, is that this is modulo P minus 1. If it is on exponent, that means that not on the exponent, it will be modulo P, And that's something that we exploit to prove this. V2 equal to V1 if the signature is valid. Okay, what is the security of this? If Eve wants to sign another message, M prime, with Alice's signature, which means that she wants to forge, she must find the value of A, because that's the part of the public key. So BGP, so this here, she must have this. This is secret, and B is public. So that means discrete log. Okay. For RSA, Eve would have to find the factorization. Here you have to find the discrete log. And then this secret number K with any new message must be different. If you want to sign another message, you find a different K. This also holds for the cipher system. If you remember, we have had that in the lecture. Okay, that was El Gamal signature. Now, what if we want to sign in ciphered message? Okay, so not the public one. So suppose Alice wants to send a signed in cipher message to Bob, and that's X. First of all, she computes the signature, and then enciphers X, and she enciphers the signature by means of Bob's public key. And then we have the ciphertext Z transmitted to Bob. What does Bob do? He must decipher first. So Bob deciphers Z by means of his private key, and he obtains X and Y, and then he uses the verification function of Alice, VA, to verify the signature, because now he has decrypted message and decrypted signature. So the procedure is as usual once he deciphers. And finally, we have to say something about signing and hashing. Why hashing? Because that's efficient. Hash is short compared to the input message. And if you use digital signature and public key ciphers, which are used for digital signatures, that's slow. So if the original message is signed, the signature is at least as long as the message, and that's inefficient. Okay. Now, another problem, even though it's not a big problem because the probability of meaningful message is small, still, she can generate the message such that it's always verified. Yeah. So if you want to prevent even this and be much more efficient, then you sign a hash message. So the hash function is public. Everybody knows that it is Ketchak, for example. And we start with the message X, compute F of X, and that's much shorter than X. It's like 512 bits or 256 bits, etc., etc., unlike X that can be 2000 bits, for example. Then Alice computes the signature, Y is SA of F of X, not of X, and sends the pair XY to Bob. Now, the essence of this is that everybody knows F, so it can be considered a part of the verification procedure. So Bob computes F of X because he has received this, so he knows X. Okay, it's not in cipher. If it is in cipher, you in the end encipher all that, and then Bob first deciphers and then repeats this procedure. Okay, so he knows X and he knows Y, which is obtained this way. So he computes F of X and then runs verification algorithm on F of X instead of X. And if he gets true, then the Alice's signature is verified. So it's very similar, but you consider that hash function is used instead of X in the signing procedure and also in the verification procedure. Now, how can Eve forge? So Eve has X because it's transmitted through the channel. And Y is SA of F of X. She doesn't know SA. She knows F as everybody else. X is on the channel, so she knows X as well. So she would like to sign her own message X prime with Alice's signature, which means to forge the signature. So she needs SA of F of X prime, which would be the same as SA of F of X. But that means that F of X prime must be the same as F of X. So it's a bad hash function. It's not second preimage resistant. So if it is second preimage resistant, this is very difficult to find. And that's why she cannot forge. Otherwise, she would just replace this value with her own value, obtained with SA prime, SA of F of X prime. Well, that's the end of this course. See you in the afternoon in the exercise where we are going to demonstrate the digital signatures and we are going to show you some system that is free of charge, which means open source and can be used to manipulate polynomials, etc., etc., to do the operations in Galois fields, which may be very useful. Okay.